in Western Britain, Southwestern Britain, and Western France. We can account for the presence of Q-Celtic in Northern Britain because we know from the historical record that Irish settlers brought the Irish language to what is now Scotland. And we know that speakers of P-Celtic took their language to Brittany. Otherwise, it's very clear that Q-Celtic is an Irish phenomenon and P-Celtic is a British phenomenon. That is, it is associated with the island of Britain. How do we explain this division? Scholars used to account for it by matching up the linguistic map with a traditional view of how the Celts had arrived in the British Isles and Ireland. As we have seen, it used to be thought that the Celts invaded Britain and Ireland in the centuries before Christ from Gaul and brought the whole Celtic toolkit with them, language, art, everything. But if so, how are we to account for the fact that Celtic comes in these two big varieties, P-Celtic and Q-Celtic? The ingenious solution that scholars came up with was to propose that there had been two different Celtic invasions, one by Q-Celtic speakers and one by P-Celtic speakers. Now, Q-Celtic looks more archaic to linguists for various reasons, including the fact that it never gets its P back. So the idea was that you have an initial wave of invaders crossed from the continent into Britain and thence into Ireland, where they conquered the previous inhabitants and then settled down to speak their Q-Celtic language. Several centuries later, a second wave of Celtic speakers, this time P-Celtic speakers, invades the island of Britain, but never makes it as far as Ireland. They simply conquer any Q-Celtic speakers in Britain who haven't made it all the way to Ireland, plus any of the indigenous inhabitants of Britain who are left, and thus you have P-Celtic prevailing in Britain while Q-Celtic continues to be spoken in Ireland. It's a nice theory. The problem is, as we've seen, there's no evidence for it whatsoever. There doesn't seem to have been any invasion. The people in Britain and Ireland were probably speaking Celtic languages for hundreds, if not thousands, of years before Christ. And we still aren't really sure how or why the Celtic languages got there. Maybe the theory of the languages arising in the context of trading is at least partially correct. And linguists are now dividing up both the extinct continental Celtic languages and the modern Celtic languages in new ways that are at least suggestive of a very fluid and interesting history that we can only get a glimpse of today. If you look at some of the new Spanish evidence for Celtic languages, it seems as if the Spanish Celtic languages may have been Q-Celtic, whereas Gaulish, the Celtic language spoken in what is now France, was P-Celtic. Maybe Celtic arrived in Ireland from Spain and in Britain from Gaul. That would at least be the simplest explanation for what we see. But all we can really say at this point is that the old model of Celtic spreading out of Hallstatt in Central Europe is probably wrong, and that the whole picture is much more complicated than we used to think. With that said, I want to spend the rest of this lecture talking about things we do know about Celtic languages, namely some of their most striking characteristics. I already mentioned one of the most noticeable, which is the loss of the Indo-European P sound, which Welsh later got back. Another one of these notable characteristics is the absence in Celtic of the verb to have. We might think of this verb as pretty indispensable. Possession is 9 points of the law, after all. How do you denote possession without the verb to have? Well, in Celtic, you use the verb to be plus a preposition. Things are literally at the person who possesses them. A quick example. If I want to say, I have a couple of words of Irish, which means I speak only a little bit of Irish, I say in Irish, Tá cúpla focal gael gagam. And this literally means, a few words of Irish are at me. So far, these features are interesting, but not particularly scary. They would not deter the casual language learner by themselves. The most distinctive feature of the Celtic languages by far, and the one that causes shivers to run down the spine of language learners, is called initial mutation. What this means is that words in the Celtic languages can change their beginning sound based on the properties of the word that comes right before them. This means that words in Celtic languages are not the masters of their own fate. Let me illustrate again with a very simple example that I learned when I was in school in Ireland. Let's start with the Irish word for I understand, which is tigum. Irish, like Spanish or Italian, does not need to express the pronoun. So tigum is I understand. So far, so good. Now let's turn this into a question. Do you understand? Watch what happens to the verb tigum. In Irish, this is undigintu. Let's ignore the change in the ending of the verb. That's not going to bother anybody who has studied French or Spanish. But why does the word now start with a D? It turns out that you have to start the question with the word an, which signifies that a question is coming. And that word, that little word, by some magical linguistic property, turns the T sound of the following verb into a D. Though, to represent this on paper, we just put the D in front of the T to remind ourselves of what the word looked like to begin with. In linguistic terms, this is called the voicing of initial consonants, otherwise known as eclipsis. There are many other situations in Irish in which an initial T would get changed to a D. If that were not bad enough, let's answer the question, do you understand, in the negative. In Irish, that would be ní hicum. Now, the negative particle, ní, has the effect of turning the initial T in the verb into an H sound. This is called lenition, but here we represent the change on paper by inserting the H after the T. Just like with eclipsis, there are many different grammatical contexts in which you have to change the initial T sound to an H sound. So there are two different initial mutations you need to keep track of, and if you get them wrong, you are saying something totally different. Now imagine that you're trying to look up an Irish word you hear in an Irish dictionary. If you encounter it in one of its mutated forms, it's going to start with the wrong letter. You just have to know that an initial D sound after the particle un might really be disguising an initial T, because the dictionary is only going to list the word in its original unmutated form. Good luck. Celtic languages have many other grammatical peculiarities, but without a doubt, initial mutation is the one that causes the most headaches to speakers of English. So what light can the Celtic languages shed on the problem of Celtic origins and identity? So far, the picture is more complicated than we used to think, and thus more fascinating. Celtic may have arisen in Western Europe rather than in Central Europe, as scholars used to think, but it's also possible that Celtic underwent some mysterious developments in the remote past that brought Celtic speakers into contact with peoples in almost every corner of the Indo-European world. We know that the Celtic words were borrowed into Latin, and that tells us that the Celts and the Romans were very familiar with each other's culture. And we can guess that the divisions between the modern Celtic languages preserve some record of the different ways in which Celtic made its way to Britain and Ireland. Beyond that, of course, we have the languages themselves in all their glorious complexity. In future lectures, we will look at the literature of the Celtic languages in detail, because if we can be certain of anything about the Celts, it's the fact that language and literature were central to their society.
Lecture 5. Caesar and the Gauls.
Welcome back. So far, we've looked at three major ways in which we can approach the Celts: through the writings of the classical authors who encountered them, through the artifacts that archaeologists dig out of the ground, and through the languages that they spoke. We've seen that the picture we get of the Celts is varied. They're not one monolithic people, and they didn't form a single empire, although a lot of older books will represent them this way. So far, we've mostly talked about the Celts in rather broad terms. We've covered the whole area that has traditionally been associated with the Celts. In this lecture, we'll concentrate on a very specific encounter between the Celts and the classical world, because it was so important that it deserves a whole lecture to itself. I'll be looking at the process by which Rome finally conquered and assimilated the Gaulish territory in both northern Italy and what is now France. And I'll focus particularly on Julius Caesar's famous conquest of Gaul. We'll see that the Celts often got drawn into the larger story of the slow but inexorable growth of Roman power in the Western Mediterranean. In contrast to the raids by the Celts on Italy and Greece that we talked about earlier, Caesar's campaigns in Gaul targeted the homeland of the Celts themselves. The story of why Caesar went into Gaul is fascinating, and it involves quite a bit of political intrigue on both the Roman side and the Gaulish side. In order to tell this story, I'm going to first set the scene by describing the political situation between the Gauls and the Romans leading up to the mid-first century BC. It turns out that the Romans and the Gauls had a long history of conflict in Italy itself that might have prepared the way for at least some Romans to support his efforts to conquer Gaul. Then I'll talk about how the conquest came about, and finally, I'll describe the aftermath. We have to back up all the way to the mid-third century BC, and we need to start not in Gaul, but in northern Italy, which was a Celtic-speaking area. You'll remember that after the clashes between the Gauls and the Romans in the 4th century BC, the Romans had pushed back against the Gauls living in northern Italy, in the Po Valley, a region that they called Cisalpine Gaul, or Gaul this side of the Alps. By the 220s BC, the Romans had thoroughly militarized this region. They had imposed Roman garrisons on the population, and they were planting colonies of Romans among the native Celts, whose most important tribe was called the Boii. But the Boii were not giving up just yet. The Romans had other enemies, and the Boii were open to allying with those enemies. In the spring of 218 BC, an envoy arrived in Cisalpine Gaul from Hannibal, the famous Carthaginian commander, seeking an alliance with the Boii against the Romans. Then Hannibal famously crossed the Alps with a huge army and a few elephants, and he did so with the help of local Gaulish guides. Once he arrived in northern Italy, the Boii rebelled against the Roman garrisons in their midst and joined forces with Hannibal. So that means the Gauls of northern Italy have just thrown in their lot with the most dangerous enemy the Romans had ever faced. And the Boii and their Celtic neighbors were absolutely crucial to Hannibal's success in advancing south toward Rome. The Romans found out about Hannibal's movements and sent an army north to try to stop him. But the army of the Boii was able to delay the Romans long enough for Hannibal to make it safely into the Po Valley. Then the Romans fought two battles with Hannibal and lost both of them. In each case, Hannibal benefited from intelligence provided by the local Celtic population. When it was clear that Hannibal was making a go of his invasion, thousands of Celtic warriors joined Hannibal's army, and they were prominent in Hannibal's great victory at Lake Trasimeno, where an entire Roman army was destroyed. Hannibal then headed south, but skirted the city of Rome, which he wrongly believed to be well defended. The Roman commander Varro marched out of the city to meet Hannibal. The battle that followed, the Battle of Cannae, was the largest military disaster in Roman history. Livy tells us that 50,000 Roman troops were killed. Hannibal relied heavily on Celtic cavalry, who drew the Romans into trouble by feigning a retreat. After the battle, the surviving Roman soldiers were forced to go under the yoke, which was a form of ritual humiliation. So Celts from northern Italy were instrumental in bringing about Rome's greatest military disaster. Hannibal eventually lost the war, of course, but the close alliance between the northern Italian Celts and Rome's fiercest opponent did not exactly endear the Celts to the Romans, and Rome spent the next several decades systematically conquering the Celtic territory of northern Italy and Romanizing any of the Celts who were not driven across the Alps. You'll remember that Gaul had been divided into Transalpine Gaul and Cisalpine Gaul, or Gaul across the Alps and Gaul on this side of the Alps. Now, Cisalpine Gaul was nicknamed Gallia Togata, or the Gaul of those who wear the toga. And by the 1st century BC, the former Cisalpine Gaul was just part of Italy. Incidentally, Transalpine Gaul was also renamed. Its new designation was Gallia Comata, or Hairy Gaul. This was a reference to the fact that the Gauls wore their hair long and did not shave their beards, unlike the clean-shaven Romans. So in these new names for Gaul, we see that the territory of the Gauls has now been divided into the region in northern Italy where the Gauls had been culturally and politically assimilated to Rome, and the region in what is now France, where they had not. But the Celts of Gallia Togata did make one last stand against Rome. They played an important role in the well-known slave revolt led by Spartacus, which was depicted in a famous movie from 1960 starring Kirk Douglas. In 73 BC, a Thracian gladiator named Spartacus broke out of captivity in southern Italy and gathered a large army consisting largely of Celts, including his two most important generals. Spartacus moved north in an effort to meet up with the Celts of the Po Valley, but he was eventually cornered and killed, probably in battle. Still, this means that the Celts were associated with two of the Romans' most dangerous opponents, Hannibal and Spartacus. But if Cisalpine Gaul has been thoroughly conquered and Romanized, what about Transalpine Gaul, Gaul beyond the Alps, or Hairy Gaul? What is going on there? First, we need to keep in mind the big picture of Rome's strategic priorities. I mentioned earlier that in the late 3rd century BC, Hannibal had traveled up from Spain along the Mediterranean coast to northern Italy and down through Cisalpine Gaul. This land route between Italy and Spain was crucial to the Romans if they wanted to keep in contact with their colonies in Spain. Right in the middle of this land route was the city of Massalia, a Greek colony founded in 600 BC. Massalia would become the modern city of Marseille. Massalia had developed into a crucial trading city with connections both in the Mediterranean and also deep into Celtic territory in Gaul. But the neighborhood of Massalia was rather dangerous. In the middle of the 2nd century BC, Massalia was attacked by a tribe known as the Saliates, which were referred to by Roman soldiers as Celto-Ligurians, which means that the Romans were actually confused about the identity of these people. But at any rate, the threat from the Saliates continued, and so Massalia called on Rome for help. Rome took the opportunity to make a deal with Massalia. Sure, we'll help you against your enemies, but in return, we want to annex your hinterland. Massalia was up against it, so they said yes, and Rome then sought out and defeated some of the Celtic allies of the Saliates to the north of Massalia. Rome thereby acquired an important strip of coastal territory in Gaul that they named simply the Province, which is the origin of the modern French name of the region, Provence. But Celtic Gaul was by no means a stable place. Various Celtic tribes jockeyed for supremacy, and one tribe in particular, the Cimbri, became a threat to Rome around 113 BC. The Cimbri had arrived in Gaul from somewhere in northwestern Europe, possibly from as far north as Jutland and Denmark, though this is highly uncertain. At any rate, they appeared in the Rhone Valley, just north of Massalia, in the territory that the Romans now considered their own backyard, and they began stirring up trouble. The Cimbri allied with other tribes, including the mysterious Teutones, who joined in the war against Rome, and over the course of less than a decade, various Gaulish tribes defeated four large Roman armies sent to contain them. By 105 BC, there was nothing between the Gaulish armies and Rome itself, and the people of Rome were panicking. Then something unexpected happened. Instead of heading for Rome, the Cimbri and Teutones turned around and headed west for Iberia, where they plundered for a while before being driven out in turn by the Celt-Iberians. The Romans had really been lucky there, but it would be easy to see why Gaul was considered a threat to the security of the empire. And the threat was not over. In 102 BC, a group of Teutones and another tribe called the Ambrones moved south to threaten the Po Valley. But this time, they had picked the wrong Roman general to go up against. The Roman commander was Gaius Marius, who is most famous today for having reorganized the Roman army into a professional fighting force. Marius drove the Teutones and Ambrones back up into Gaul and caught them near Aix, where he encircled them and slaughtered them. Supposedly, there was so much blood spilled on the battlefield that it brought forth bumper crops of grain for several years thereafter. The following year, Marius won another major victory against the Gauls, and that was the end of the aggressive threat that they posed to the city of Rome. It had been a long, hard slog, though, and the Romans remembered how tough it had been to defeat them. For a few generations after the Roman victories under Marius, there was relative peace in Gaul, but things were still far from stable, because starting in the mid-60s BC, Gaul began to be threatened by new invaders from the north and east, namely various tribes of Germans. As these people began putting pressure on Celtic territory, the inhabitants of Gaul began remilitarizing in response. In particular, the various tribal federations reoccupied the large hill forts that had characterized the area hundreds of years earlier. These fortresses are known to us by the Latin word oppida. The singular is oppidum. An oppidum was basically a glorified hill fort, but these oppida were very strong militarily. Often they were defended by walls of stone or timber and extensive earthworks. You did not just assault one of these without a lot of preparation. Interestingly, the story of the Roman conquest of Gaul, in a sense, demonstrates not that the Celtic tribes were barbaric, but rather that they were not all that different from their neighbors to the south, despite what Caesar might have wanted the readers of his commentaries on the Gallic War to believe. We have to keep in mind that the rulers of these federations were subject to the same political pressures and infighting as any of the other states on the borders of the Roman Empire. The Gauls had to figure out whether it made more sense to fight the Romans or make a deal with them, which was just exactly the calculation that was being made all along the borders of Roman territory. The Gauls were simply outmaneuvered and outfought, just like the Carthaginians and the Greeks and the many other peoples the Romans defeated. But let's get on to Caesar. The story of Julius Caesar and the Gauls used to be familiar to every educated Westerner because almost everyone learned Latin by reading Caesar's commentaries on the Gallic War. I mentioned Caesar's writings about the Gauls when I talked in more general terms about the classical view of the Celts, because Caesar relied heavily on the work of earlier authors who wrote about the Celts, such as Posidonius. This is actually rather surprising in a sense, because you would have thought that since Caesar fought the Gauls and presumably spent a reasonable amount of time in their company, he wouldn't need to use other people's writings about them, but he did. And as a result, we don't really learn much that is new about Celtic customs from Caesar. But we do learn a great deal about the wars that Caesar fought against the Gauls, even if we have to perhaps allow for a little bit of self-serving exaggeration on Caesar's part. And we have another reason to thank Caesar. He is so famous that anything associated with him is immediately glamorous. So some of the earliest archaeological digs in France in the late 19th century were designed to identify Caesar's battlefields. The French public wanted to find the traces of Caesar, and this effort ended up producing a lot of great information about the Gaulish period generally, quite apart from Caesar himself. So let's get down to our story. It's the middle of the 1st century BC. The Celtic-speaking tribes in Gaul have consolidated themselves into several major coalitions. Caesar tells us that all Gaul was divided into three parts. Roughly speaking, they are Aquitania in the southwest, which is where we get the later name Aquitaine from, Belgica in the north, the origin of our word Belgium, and Celtica, which is essentially now central and southeastern France. The main events that touched off the conquest happened in the Celtica region. In many ways, the Roman conquest of Gaul was really kind of an accident, and it involved serious political rivalries within the ruling elites of both Rome and Gaul. Here's how it went down. Two of the most important tribal groupings in Celtica were the Sequani, who lived on the western bank of the Rhine, and the Ædui, who lived just to the west of them in what is now central France. In 71 BC, the Sequani and the Ædui got involved in a quarrel. We're not sure what it was about. The Sequani needed some help, and they decided to call in their neighbors from the eastern bank of the Rhine, a Germanic tribe called the Suebi, led by a chieftain called Ariovistus. The problem was, once the Suebi arrived on the scene, they didn't want to go home. After they defeated the Ædui, they stuck around and began exacting tribute from the Celtic tribes in the vicinity. The Ædui decided to look for allies of their own, and the most powerful people they could think of to call on were the Romans. So in 60 BC, the chieftain of the Ædui, a man named Divitiacus, appealed to Rome for help against the Germans. You would have thought the whole experience with the Germans would have taught him not to do this, but oh well. Lest we think the Gauls were barbarians without any appreciation of the Roman world, we should keep in mind that when Divitiacus visited Rome, he was the guest of Cicero's younger brother, and Cicero himself mentions Divitiacus in his letters. Divitiacus addressed the Roman Senate to ask for an alliance. He returned to Gaul with some sort of vague promise of Roman help, and Cicero certainly backed the idea of an alliance with the Ædui. But Roman politics did not break in a way that favored the Gauls. Cicero's most dangerous political opponent was Julius Caesar, a rising star who became consul in 59 BC. Whatever Cicero favored, Julius Caesar was bound to oppose. He decided that instead of backing an alliance with the Ædui under Divitiacus, Rome should make an alliance with the Germans under Ariovistus. The fact that Julius Caesar was on the German side just made the Suebi even bolder, and they made even more inroads into Celtic territory. By this point, the various tribes of Gaul were split internally over whether it made sense to accommodate themselves to outside domination, whether by Romans or by Germans. This was the perpetual dilemma faced by everyone the Romans came into contact with. Many tribal leaders, like Divitiacus of the Ædui, thought this was the best bet they had. But the younger brother of Divitiacus, a man called Dumnorix, thought that cozying up to the Romans was getting them nowhere. He put out feelers to his father-in-law, Orgetorix, the chieftain of the Helvetii, who were a large Celtic tribe that occupies the territory now known as Switzerland. In fact, the official name of Switzerland is the Confederatio Helvetica, or the Helvetian Confederation, a nod to the Helvetii. Orgetorix also made an alliance with the disaffected son of the chieftain of the Sequani, a man named Causticos. The idea of this alliance was to bring together all the Celts in one united federation to resist encroachment by either the Germans or the Romans. But let's leave these conspirators aside for a moment and look at what was going on in Roman politics, because it would have a huge impact on the future of Gaul. In 60 BC, Julius Caesar had entered into a pact with two other powerful Roman political figures, Pompey the Great and Crassus. This alliance is known now as the First Triumvirate. The alliance was not founded on mutual respect, however, but on the recognition that none of the three was yet powerful enough to do in the others. The three men basically carved up the Roman Empire into spheres of influence. Caesar got the provinces of Illyricum, Cisalpine Gaul, and Gallia Narbonensis, which was another name for the province or Provence. These were not the richest parts of the empire. Pompey and Crassus got those. If Caesar was going to make a profit, both economically and politically, he was going to need to expand the territory under his command. Where was Caesar going to expand into? Gaul. And in 58 BC, Caesar got the perfect excuse. when the Celtic world suddenly became even more unstable than usual. Several Germanic tribes began moving into the territory of the Helvetii from the north and the northeast, and the Helvetii decided to move west to get out of their way. By this point, their chieftain, Orgetorix, had died. This migration seems to have been carefully orchestrated in advance. It was not a panicked flight. Rather, it was an orderly mass movement made possible by the alliance I mentioned earlier between Dumnorix of the Aedui and Casticos of the Sequani. The Helvetii made arrangements with both men to let them pass through their respective territories so that they could settle to their west in Gaul. But we need to keep in mind that Dumnorix and Casticos were not calling the shots for the Aedui and the Sequani. Remember that the chieftain of the Aedui, Dividiacos, was pro-Roman. He had made a speech to the Senate to ask for a Roman alliance. Despite the fact that Julius Caesar had not been interested in a Roman alliance with the Aedui a few years earlier, Dividiacos was willing to give it another shot. He sent word to Caesar that the Helvetii were on the move. Caesar was eager to demonstrate to the other two members of the triumvirate, as well as to the Roman population at large, that he was fully capable of protecting his province of Gallia Narbonensis from these migrating Gauls. So Caesar marched north to meet the Helvetii. They turned northwest into the territory of the Aedui, and Caesar followed. The arrival of Caesar blew open the tensions among the Aedui between pro-Roman and anti-Roman factions. Many of the Aedui were giving aid to the Helvetii. Caesar demanded that they cease and desist, and he probably called for the capture and elimination of Dividiacos' anti-Roman brother, Dumnorix. But Dividiacos did not give his brother up. He apparently told Caesar, through an interpreter, that it would be politically dangerous for him to do so, and that he would lose standing, not just among his own people, but throughout Gaul. This is a sign that anti-Roman sentiment in Gaul was growing across tribal boundaries. Despite the failure of Dividiacos to cooperate, Caesar went after the Helvetii and caught them. In a series of battles, he massacred huge numbers. Of the 400,000 members of the Helvetii who began their migration, only a quarter survived, and these survivors were forced to go back to their homeland, where they were eventually overrun by incoming German tribes, and their language died out. Caesar's demonstration of ruthlessness led some of the other tribes in Gaul to decide that making peace with Caesar was by far the best option, and they figured that if they did so, Caesar might help them against Ariovistus and his Germans. Caesar challenged Ariovistus, who defied him. Ariovistus began gathering his forces in the territory of the Sequani, who were anti-Roman Celts. Caesar then went after Ariovistus and destroyed his army, which meant there was now nobody else for the Romans to compete against in Gaul. The following year, 57 BC, Caesar moved north to campaign against the Belgae, who were the least Romanized of the Gauls. He carried out a brutal campaign of sieges and slaughter. The year after that, Caesar conquered the Veneti, a seafaring people who lived on the Armorican Peninsula in what is now Brittany. He then defeated another attempted German incursion into Gaul. Caesar reports himself that of 430,000 members of the tribes, only a few survived. And when he finished with the Germans, Caesar undertook two extended raids into the island of Britain in 55 and 54 BC. It's actually better to call them raids than invasions because it's not clear that Caesar was really prepared to stay for very long. I'll talk more about Caesar and Britain in a future lecture. The main theater was clearly Gaul, and there Caesar had been spectacularly successful. However, a major revolt in 54 to 52 BC nearly undid Caesar's accomplishments. In 54 BC, the political winds shifted throughout Gaul in favor of the anti-Roman party, and almost the whole of Gaul rose in rebellion, led by a chieftain of the Treveri tribe, a man named Indutio Maros. Caesar's response was to put a price on Indutio Maros' head. Indutio Maros was ambushed and killed by a Gaulish traitor. After several other brutal campaigns in 53 BC, Caesar reestablished control sufficiently to withdraw from Gaul for the winter. But the Gauls were not yet cowed. Caesar found a worthy opponent in a man named Vercingetorix, who was named the chieftain of the Arverni tribe in 52 BC. The Arverni controlled the territory in south-central France near what is now Clermont-Ferrand. As soon as Vercingetorix took power, he set about creating an alliance to resist Roman rule. He went up against Caesar at the Battle of Gergovia, the chief oppidum of the Arverni, and he actually defeated Caesar, one of the only times Caesar was ever defeated in battle. This victory obviously put heart into the Gaulish resistance, but ultimately Caesar prevailed. The last stand of Vercingetorix was very dramatic. He holed up in the fortress of Alesia near Dijon in north-central France. Caesar decided to besiege him in Alesia. But sieges could be very dangerous because you're always vulnerable to a counter-siege. While you are surrounding someone inside a city, someone else can come along and surround you. So Vercingetorix called on his Gaulish allies to do just that, to come and surround Caesar. But Caesar knew just what to do. He built a fortress of his own, facing out towards the armies that might come to relieve Alesia. Although the Gaulish allies who arrived to help were not as numerous as Vercingetorix might have hoped, they were still able to spot a weakness in Caesar's fortifications, and when the Gaulish allies on the outside combined with Vercingetorix's forces on the inside, they nearly squeezed Caesar between them and defeated him. But then Caesar personally took command of the very last reserves he had available to them, and he saved the day. Of course, we should keep in mind that we know all of this from Caesar's own pen. It's possible that he is making these events sound a bit more dramatic than they actually were. The end of the story of Vercingetorix is really rather tragic. A much later tradition in the lives of Plutarch reports that Vercingetorix surrendered in a rather flamboyant fashion. He rode his horse out of the fortress of Alesia and around Caesar's camp before pulling up in front of Caesar, dismounting, and stripping himself of all of his military accoutrements. He then stayed absolutely still until he was taken away. It's worth stating that Caesar himself does not report this story. Now, Caesar was obviously an eyewitness, and he was writing much closer in time to these events. But he also had an incentive to make himself look good and Vercingetorix look bad. So we just have to decide which account to believe, or neither. There is no debate about what happened next. Vercingetorix was taken off to captivity in Rome until it was finally time for Caesar's triumph to be celebrated, 5 years later. A Roman triumph is an extremely grand ceremony that commemorates a splendid military achievement, and it involves a huge parade of the spoils of war, including prominent captives. So Vercingetorix was paraded through the streets of Rome, where he presumably had to put up with the jeers and other abuse of the crowd, and then returned to his prison, where he was probably strangled, as was the custom with the defeated enemies of the Romans. Thus ended the last major rebel against Roman rule in Gaul. So what were the consequences of Caesar's victories over the Gauls for Celtic culture in Gaul? We know that Roman culture quickly became widespread throughout Gaul, at least in the areas that were within easy distance of Roman settlements, and also all along the Roman road network. There, the Latin language came into very wide use, and all the trappings of Roman civilization followed the legions, including characteristic forms of Roman architecture and urban planning, such as aqueducts and amphitheaters. But we have evidence also that the Gaulish language persisted. The evidence comes from a remarkable artifact known as the Coligny calendar, which was made in the 2nd century AD. It's really a kind of perpetual calendar made out of a bronze tablet. This is how it worked. The bronze tablet was divided into 16 columns, and there was a hole in each day for the insertion of a peg to show the current day of the month. The labels on the calendar are in the Gaulish language, but in the Roman alphabet. The existence of this calendar is evidence of the survival not just of the Gaulish language, but also of this very important aspect of Gaulish culture, the reckoning of time. Ultimately, of course, Gaulish did fade away, but it left some important traces in the French language that is descended from the Latin that replaced it. Here are just a few examples. The French verb aller, to go, is descended from a Gaulish word, as is the word for lark, alouette, as in the famous children's song, alouette, gentille alouette. Carrying on with the bird theme, the French word bec for beak is also Gaulish, and that is, of course, where our word beak comes from as well, via the French spoken in England by the Norman conquerors. The French word for horse, cheval, is Gaulish in origin, as is the word petit, or little. Many of these Gaulish words refer to features of the natural landscape, such as the names of trees, like fir or maple, or kinds of settings, like scrubland or a copse or a sandy beach. One can easily imagine the Roman conquerors of Gaul asking the local names for these things and incorporating them into their speech, where they remained and preserved for us the legacy of the ancient Gauls. It had been very hard fought, but the Gauls were now firmly under Roman rule. The last remaining areas of Celtic speech outside of the Roman Empire were Britain and Ireland. We will look in detail at the Roman encounter with Celtic Britain shortly, but in the next lecture, we'll pause to talk about the religion of the Celts.
Lecture 6, Celtic Religion and the Druids.
Welcome back. Last time I talked about the Roman conquest of Gaul, but I want to pause in the chronological narrative here to talk about a very important subject about which too little is known, namely religion and the Celts, and particularly the role of Druids in Celtic society. I'll look at the general beliefs of the Celtic peoples insofar as we can get at them, and then we'll talk about Druids in some detail, because, let's face it, Druids are cool. But our task in this lecture will be difficult, and much of what I will say will be frustratingly general and tentative. Part of the problem with reconstructing pagan religion, as we've pointed out in talking about the ancient Celts in general, is the fact that we have two kinds of texts about the topic that we might use, but each of these kinds of texts has a major drawback. The first kind of text is a kind we're already familiar with, namely reports about the Celts by their neighbors in the classical world, the Romans and Greeks. These sources have all the same advantages and disadvantages with regard to learning about Celtic religion that they do when we're looking at any other aspect of the Celtic world. We can't be sure how well these writers really understood what they wrote about. But in many cases, these texts are all we have, so we need to make the best of them. The other kind of text we have is at least written by people we think of now as Celts, especially the Irish. But there are two problems with these texts. The first is that they were all written down after the Irish converted to Christianity, so you have people looking back on beliefs that they no longer hold and customs that they no longer practice, or at least that they're not supposed to be practicing. So it's hard to know if they are remembering accurately or, in fact, if they are deliberately distorting the historical record, because their new status as Christians makes them uncomfortable with that record. The second problem is that we're not entirely sure, as we've already said, and will say again, how much of a connection there is between the people of Ireland, say, and the people of Gaul. Do we have any right even to expect that their beliefs would be the same? That is a question we will need to leave somewhat open. But there are at least some intriguing parallels that could make us inclined to accept a connection between different areas of the Celtic-speaking world after all. Now, one reason to look at Celtic religion is precisely because this topic should help us answer the question of whether we can see anything distinctive that unites the so-called Celtic peoples across space and time. But in fact, the evidence for diversity of beliefs is just as compelling as the evidence for unity. Celtic mythology is hard to reconstruct, but it seems to have focused on a pantheon of nature-related gods and also belief in an other world that was located either across the sea or under the ground. That seems to be a bottom line that we observe across all Celtic-speaking territories. But when we start to get specific, the picture is murkier. If we were to plot a map with mentions of the various deities that the Celts worshipped, there would be some common cults that appear over wide stretches of territory. But there are also many, many gods that were highly localized. It is hard, if not impossible, to reconstruct anything like a Celtic pantheon that stretches across all the Celtic lands. But we have to be brave and proceed. So let's start with what the classical world thought about what the ancient Celts believed. One of the aspects of Celtic belief that struck the classical authors the most forcefully was their fixation with treasure, especially gold, which was often offered as a sacrifice to their gods. We have several reports of how the Gauls would deposit large amounts of gold and silver in their temples, and Strabo reports in amazement that the treasure would be absolutely safe. Nobody would think of touching it. But according to Posidonius, besides offering treasure as a sacrifice in temples, the Gauls would deposit gold and silver in lakes. We know that the Celts believed in an other world, for which water was a kind of boundary. So by depositing the treasure in lakes, they were essentially sending it to the realm of the gods. And by the way, this habit of depositing valuable objects in water continued for hundreds, even thousands of years after the period of Celtic dominance in Gaul. French peasants were still depositing precious objects in water in the medieval period. So you have all these Gauls throwing gold and silver into lakes, and this becomes known to the Romans. What are the very pragmatic Romans going to do about it? Strabo tells us that whenever a Gaulish region was conquered, the Roman authorities would auction off these lakes to raise money for the public treasury. Presumably, the buyers of the lakes would then drain them. It helps that the Romans are excellent engineers. And then scoop up all the treasure at the bottom. We have evidence that the Celts had some kind of mystical connection to birds. A historian from the late 3rd century BC named Eudoxus reported that if the plagues of locusts descended on the crops of the Celts would use special prayers and offer special sacrifices to attract flocks of birds who would come and eat the locusts. And this sounds like a kind of early organic pest control. Birds are a common element in reports about Celtic beliefs, but they didn't always play the same role. There's a report from a late 2nd century BC writer named Artemidorus of Ephesus, who traveled all the way to the western Mediterranean, that a later writer named Strabo included in his geography, though Strabo wasn't sure it was true. Apparently, in some port town on the Atlantic coast of Europe, there were two crows with whitish right wings, and these crows were used to settle disputes. Two men who had a dispute would come to the crows, put a plank on an elevated place, and then each man would throw cakes of barley into the air. The birds would eat some of the cakes, but they would scatter others. The man whose cakes the birds scattered would win the dispute. Now, Strabo doesn't find this plausible. But we should remember that the classical world was full of cults in which omens that were just as strange were used to predict the future. In their use of birds for divination purposes, the Celts were firmly in the mainstream. There are also signs that the Celts attached some kind of religious or at least symbolic significance to the severed human head. Livy records a story about what happened to the Roman general Postumius when he was killed while fighting against the Boii tribe of Cisalpine Gaul in northern Italy. According to Livy, the Gauls took his severed head in a procession to their chief temple, and once the skull had been cleaned, They ornamented it with gold and used it thereafter as a drinking cup for their priests on special occasions. Now, here is a case where we do need to be somewhat careful with our sources, since Livy was writing 2 centuries later, and we also have reports of other ancient peoples using people's skulls as drinking cups. This could be a case of literary borrowing. Livy has read this story somewhere, and he thinks it'll give his account of the Gauls that extra exotic touch. Or it could actually be a case where the idea of using a human skull as a drinking cup either spontaneously occurred to different people, or the idea may have spread from one people to another. We certainly know from the many representations of the human head on various artifacts that the cult of the head was widespread, so prominent, in fact, that after the Romans had conquered Gaul, they felt called upon to ban the display of severed heads. It was just too much for the Romans. Though apparently, gladiatorial contests fought to the death and executing criminals by means of wild beasts was okay. One of the Celtic beliefs that caused the most comment among ancient writers was the belief in reincarnation, which was, incidentally, a belief that the famous Greek philosopher Pythagoras shared. Diodorus reports that the Gauls believed that a few years after death, a departed person would be reborn into a new body. He states that some Gauls would throw letters into a funeral pyre so that they could be read by people who had already died. So far, we have assembled a rather eclectic list of things that the Celts believed. They don't really amount to a systematic worldview, probably because we really don't have access to the mythological stories of the ancient Celts, and it's very hard to know how the surviving stories from Britain and Ireland do or do not correspond to stories that would have been current in Gaul, say, in the classical period. We're left with a sense that the Celts had a special reverence for certain aspects of the natural world, and that they did believe in some kind of other world or continuation of human existence after death. So who was in charge of Celtic religion? Of course, the first word that most people think of when they think of Celtic pagan religion is probably Druid. Druids seem to have been a feature of British, Irish, and Gaulish society, but they're not found in every part of Europe where Celtic languages were spoken. Druids were apparently especially popular in Britain. In fact, Julius Caesar reports that the Druid movement began in Britain, and that Gaulish Druids, who really wanted to advance their careers, actually went to Britain to study there. It's interesting that one place where you don't see them at all is Spain. So the area of Celtic speech is not exactly the same as the area where Druids were active. Caesar reports that the Druids were extremely powerful in Gaulish society. In fact, he put the Druids on an equal footing with warriors in the social pecking order in Gaul. The Druids were essentially the intelligentsia. They controlled religious life, but they were also the lawyers and judges of the Gauls. The Druids decided legal disputes, and anyone who refused to abide by their rulings was banned from religious ceremonies and ostracized by everyone. The reward for all this labor was that the Druids were exempt from combat and did not have to pay any war taxes. The high social status of Druids put them at the center of politics in Celtic territories. Druids were often seen as the heart of Celtic resistance to Roman authority. Julius Caesar worried a lot about Druids during his conquest of Gaul, and when the Romans later conquered Britain, one of their top priorities was to destroy the Druid center on the island of Mona, off the northwest coast of Wales. But if the Romans feared Druids, they were also fascinated by them, just as we are. For some very interesting details about Druids, we can turn to the natural history of the Roman author Pliny the Elder, which was written 2 years before Pliny died in the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in 79 AD. Pliny reports that the Druids worshipped only in oak groves and would not carry out their ceremonies unless a branch of that tree was present. By the way, this is one reason to be faintly suspicious of the latter-day Druids who like to worship at the summer solstice at Stonehenge. Real druids would not have been caught dead worshipping at Stonehenge. Only an oak grove would do, at least according to Pliny. Pliny also reports that the druids were particularly devoted to the mistletoe plant. The Celtic word for mistletoe supposedly meant all healing. Apparently, the druids would prepare a drink from mistletoe that was reputed to make barren livestock fertile and to counteract all poisons. Pliny reports these beliefs, but he does not share them. He says rather dismissively, "Such is the devotion to frivolous affairs shown by many peoples." So how did one get to be a druid? It was a little like getting to Carnegie Hall. You needed to practice. Druids trained for many years to master very complex texts by memory, since they did not believe in writing down sacred things. Instead, they would spend many years memorizing every aspect of druid lore. It could take as long as 20 years to become a fully trained druid. As I've said, they wanted to keep their minds sharp by exercising their memories, and they doubtless also wanted to keep arcane knowledge to themselves. But what were they keeping secret? If we knew that, we'd really be somewhere, wouldn't we? But one thing we can be fairly sure of is that the druids had a belief in fate, or at least in luck, in the sense that some times were lucky while others were unlucky. In an earlier lecture, I talked about how the Coligny calendar, which was made in the 2nd century AD, makes it clear to us that the Gaulish language was alive and well at that time. But the Coligny calendar also seems to provide confirmation that druids were in charge of determining which days were auspicious for engaging in certain activities. For example, Posidonius tells us that the druids were often in charge of deciding whether it was a good day to give battle. He tells us that it was by no means unheard of for two armies to be drawn up, ready to fight each other, when all of a sudden the druids would step between them and stop the battle from taking place. Posidonius seems rather surprised at the authority the druids have over their people, which might say something about his experience with the priests of his own culture. I mentioned earlier that one of our challenges in dealing with Celtic religion is the fact that our sources don't match. We have classical sources from the early period and Celtic sources from the later period, and we always have to wonder whether we can really draw a straight line between the world of the classical Celts and the Irish and British culture that is often associated with it. But we do have hints in Irish literature that druids were important in Ireland, and that there, too, the druids had the job of deciding what was lucky and what was not. There's a wonderful example of a druid ruling on this question of what a day was lucky for, in a famous Irish story called The Toyne, or The Cattle Raid of Cooley, which takes place in the north of Ireland. I'll talk much more about this text in a later lecture. Towards the beginning of the story, we get a kind of prologue in which we find out about the birth of a king. Supposedly, the Princess Nessa, the daughter of the King of Ulster, was looking out on the road when a druid named Cathbad came by. She asked him, "What is today lucky for?" Maybe that was just the polite question you asked a druid. Cathbad answered, presumably thinking quickly, "For begetting a king on a queen." Since there was no other man nearby, Nessa and Cathbad have a tryst. And 9 months later, the future king, Conovar, is born. Well, it turned out to be somebody's lucky day. And that somebody was Cathbad the Druid. To return to the classical period for a moment, we have a report recorded by Cicero about an actual druid. In Cicero's treatise on divination, which he addressed to his brother Quintus, he reports the following. "The practice of divination is not even neglected by barbarians. I know there are druids in Gaul because I met one myself, Dividiacus of the Edui tribe, who was your guest and praised you highly. He claimed a knowledge of nature derived from what the Greeks called physiologia, the inquiry into natural causes and phenomena. He would predict the future using augury and other forms of interpretation." Notice the charming detail that Cicero passes along the praise offered by this druid to his brother. The point of Cicero's treatise is that divination is something that everybody does, even barbarians. But the tiny whiff of snobbery is balanced out by the clear implication that Cicero is interacting with